Welcome aboard this science podcast as we fly around Earth's atmosphere, picking up the science of every individual layer. For the first part of our journey, we've gone back in time to a particular Qantas flight en route between Sydney and Singapore, and it's flying up near Indonesia. And a few hours before, it's flying in the stratosphere, and a few hours before, a Indonesian volcano has spewed volcanic ash and it's circulating around in the stratosphere. And we're on board and you hear engines one stop, four stops, three stop, two stop, and you hear a whistling sound. What will happen next? This is Peter Hill Explains, where I discuss things scientific. In this podcast is a follow-on from a podcast on water and ozone, and I resisted the temptation to give you too much information about the role of water, ozone, and we'll meet another character, carbon dioxide, in the dynamics of the atmosphere, causing so much that we take for granted in our everyday life. So I'm going to go in and drag you through the science of it. And, of course, the overall idea is the improvement of my podcasting. So I've been looking at the physical aspects, breathing and stuff like that, and now I'm looking at more the structural aspects, trying to look at where you need multiple podcasts to develop an idea, in this case, two podcasts to talk about water and ozone, and how you have overall structure. So in this case, I've got you on board, you're on this aircraft, and it's beginning to lose altitude. And remember that it is a Qantas, Queensland and Northern Territory Air Service, if you ever wanted to know what Qantas stood for, flight. And we're starting to lose altitude and pick up speed as we're heading towards the ground. Will you die? Well, because it's in the past and Qantas has never had an air crash, it's never lost an aircraft or a single person's died in Qantas. It happens to be the safest airline in the world, partly because they pay their pilots a lot and partly because the Australian airspace is so clear and there's relatively good weather on all the routes. So we're in a tropical thing, so we don't have the winter storms, all the things that have caused crashes for other airlines. It's more geography more than anything else. And, of course, also buying relatively new aircraft, a good aircraft turnover all the time. So you're not going to die. So what's happened is that we're flying in the stratosphere above the weather. The weather's in the troposphere. And we'll discuss this and get all the nomenclature correct. And we're flying along, and normally the stratosphere is completely clean. It's just air with no weather circulating the Earth, but we've been rudely interrupted by volcanic gas, which has sort of divided the standard atmospheric dynamics, and with the assistance of a volcano underneath it, shot up into the atmosphere. Volcanic ash is not ash in terms of burning, it's small bits of glass. So it's sand and metal, sand and basalt heated up together with a lot of gas. So when it expands very quickly and breaks up into tiny little fragments, basically sandpaper. And so this volcanic ash has sandpapered our engines. And to protect the various engines, the engines have switched off before they've completely destroyed themselves. And your Qantas pilot would have made an announcement in a broad Australian accent, say, "Don't panic, we know exactly what we're doing." And he's heading to the ground at incredible speed. And with this speed, at a correct altitude, he just follows textbook procedures and restarts the engine away from the volcanic ash. And I think that instance has meant that there's now radar which pick up volcanic ash. There's warnings, and flights are conservatively grounded now. So overall, you've survived that. And it's my way of introducing you to two parts of the atmosphere. The stratosphere, which is above the weather, and the weather beneath it, which is the troposphere. And just to let you into a secret, the ozone layer is the stratosphere, and the mesosphere. There's two layers there, and the ozone layer's slap bang in the middle of that, and creating, in fact, the stratosphere. So, in essence, you're on the ground, and let's go to Europe, or if in the United States, down to, I suppose, Mexico City, or wherever you fly in the United States, or in Russia, from Moscow to Vladivostok, or whatever you do. Let's go to our holiday destination. You don't think, oh, Mummy and Daddy, we're going into the ozone layer and we're going to be irradiated by all the solar radiation, and the radiation happening in space is going to irradiate us far more than we'll ever get on the ground, which is true. We don't tend to mention that. It's part of the experience, where you don't experience turbulence when you're flying. It's that monotonous sound. You may experience turbulence as you get down, and it's part of the entire solution of flight, is that you're not told of the environmental impact or exactly where you're flying. But in this podcast, you will find out exactly. As I've said before, there's three gases which we have to tell the tale of to explain what's going on. And some of the gases are, I suppose, they don't behave the way that most people think of them. But if you know the physics of things, you do understand. So what we're going to do is we're going to start off getting our orientation. This is normally you get oriented on the flatness of the Earth. This is orienting you from now vertically above your head. So what I want you to do is imagine a W shape. That W shape is going to be the temperature. Starting off to the left, going down, up, down, and off to the right. And bear with me as we go into it. So you've got that W shape, and that's the wrong orientation. I want you to pick up the left-hand corner of your W and bend it over so it's sticking and balancing on the edge of its W. So it, say if we're going to put an x-axis, it starts off at, let's say, 30, goes down to, let's say, minus 5, minus 30, then goes up again, then down again, this time to minus 100, and then up again as you go up the W, up to 80 degrees Celsius. And if you haven't guessed, the very bottom of the W, which is touching the right hand, which used to be the right hand side of the W, which is now on the bottom of the page, is the ground where we're at. And those numbers which I had are rough temperatures, and I'm just going off speaking live and just having information just pour into my mouth. So I must admit, I have forgotten at what temperature the ground temperature drops to before it starts to increase again. And so we're going to actually label parts of this W. So what I'm doing here is, it's a podcast, it's not a YouTube. I'm beginning to label some of the things for you. So we've got the ground. The first part of the atmosphere, the dense part of the atmosphere, is called the troposphere. The next, and that's going from a high temperature to low temperature. Then it swings back, increasing in temperature, and it increases in temperature in the stratosphere. And it increases to a maximum temperature. I really can't remember what it is. And when it reaches, starts bending over and coming back again, that other part of the W, that's called the mesosphere. Now, because when we do have a well-defined boundary called a pause, now it's not the menopause, the mesopause, mesosphere and mesopause, M-E-S-O, sphere. And after that, because the temperature is increasing, this is the very first part of the W, going up to 80 degrees and beyond, is the thermosphere. And above that is the exosphere. Now, just don't struggle to remember it. You can write it down at the moment, but I'll go through it in a few seconds. And so, really, what we define outer space with satellites are actually orbiting in someone else's definition of the atmosphere called the thermosphere. So I'm going to go through again and then start to paint some of the pictures of what's going on. So I'm giving you the itinerary of our journey from your ground right up to outer space, and having originally introduced what's going on in what I hope is the start of a podcasting technique of actually putting you in an aircraft and putting you in a situation. So we'll go again. It's the troposphere, stratosphere, mesosphere, thermosphere, and exosphere. Now, the troposphere is where all the weather is, the turbulence is, and there is a wild child molecule responsible for everything that's going on, a combination of two things, basically. The sun has, if it's dumping its heat in the atmosphere, it's already done that, and it's the other atmospheric transparent light, which doesn't carry heat, hits the ground, and it hits the ground at various wavelengths. The ground is a black body radiator. The ground heats up, and the ground starts transmitting heat via two methods. Radiation, infrared radiation, so it's a big infrared radiator. That's a certain amount of things. And it's also doing something called convection. So the layer of air closest to the ground heats up, becomes more buoyant. Because it's colder above, the hotter air expands. There's colder air, more dense air above, and so that cold air drops down, and so it's up and down. And so, if you like, it's if it's a house, it's the ground floor, the kids' ground floor, and the kids are running up and down. I'm trying to give you a mental picture, hopefully not too many mental pictures, but in general, you can think of floors of a house as our experience. And so upstairs and the attic, or upstairs, is going to be the stratosphere where the parents are, nice and, you know, smooth dining, not much happening, people well vacuumed. And then the attic region is the mesosphere, and then above it is the air above it is the exosphere. This is just to give you a mental picture. So we've got the atmosphere when it's sitting on the ground having buoyancy, and I've told you that water is a bit of a wild child. And I'd say 1 in 100 people, that's really fascinating when they hear this fact. Another fraction, say 80 in 100, say I don't care, and then I think that leaves you 19 out of 100. Are quite aggressive. They get really aggressive when they hear this fact. So listen to this fact, keep it to yourself, and don't tell it too many people before you find out about who you're dealing with. So the first thing I'm going to tell you is that water is lighter than air. And people automatically think a glass of water, that doesn't float. The sea, it doesn't float. Well, there is something floating in your glass of water, because your glass of water is evaporating, and that water vapor, you can't see it, is going rising all the time. And well, have a little talk to. Imagine the water vapor was hydrogen gas that's got a mass of 2U compared, and I've covered U in a previous, what I've covered U, I've covered the letter U, U the unit. Yeah, so there is a unit of a unit. It's got a mass of 2 units. Nitrogen has 28, oxygen 32. Nitrogen's the major component of air. So a hydrogen will float up, and you can expect helium will float up. Helium's 4U. Water, which is hydrogen, 1U. Oxygen, 16U. Another hydrogen, another U, it's got an atomic mass of 18. Water itself is lighter than air. The water molecules are lighter than air, and they tend to go up to the rise upwards, and sometimes with quite a lot of pressure starts to float upwards. So if there's a body of water, you'll see a column of ascending air above it. The eagles know about this, the various birds, and they fly around underneath it, and the air rises up until it forms a cloud. And we have another process which happens when it forms a cloud. But so if you are a pilot, you look for the clouds, a lone puffy white cloud, and you fly underneath it, because underneath that cloud is a column of ascending air, and what's ascending about it is the heat, and water ascends, and it rises up until it, it condenses. And this is another mad thing that happens, that when the water condenses, it actually gets pulled out of the atmosphere and creates a vacuum system. So if you have water in a can, heat it up and invert it such that the can is closed, the can will collapse due to the vacuum. So there is a vacuum effect here. So we've got many things going along. So water is a sort of a wild child. So as the sun hits the ground, it creates convection, and then water-assisted convection, which is completely mad. And then convection, water-assisted convection, assisted further still by cloud formation, which is causes a sudden drop in pressure and creates a vacuum effect. Now, of course, this is why clouds are at a certain height. They're only at a certain height because the water beneath them hasn't condensed yet. And when it reaches a certain height, it will begin to fall, but when it falls again, it will go to a higher temperature, at lower atmosphere, and evaporate. And so your clouds are falling, but as they fall, they disappear, then float up again and reignite. So there's this continuous process which is happening here. And water really is a wild child, and you have convection happening here. And of course, that's going to stop at a certain point. We should discuss a little bit further that if I have a lot of energy stored in the ground, the ground can be quite hot, and then when water falls on top of that, that can actually evaporate very quickly and rise up very high, and there can be this vacuum effect, and the water can actually be sucked up. And you will actually see this in a cloud. You can see it around here in the Blue Mountains. And watch out, the thunderstorms forming. You see these chimneys appearing. You get these clouds, and you look at the clouds, and you can see, it's going to be a thunderstorm. And it starts off these chimneys, and they grow from the bottom of the stratosphere. So just to start again, when you look up, you'll have a cloud layer. That's your... it's still high moisture content, it's just beneath the clouds, the water hasn't condensed yet, so that's why the clouds are up in the sky. Now, it's a bit more complex thing that I teach listening to that, and will say, oh, stupid, clouds are lighter than air, that's why they're up there. Oh, it's really crazy, but we're at the thing, a very hot day. It's been hot. This is a tropical thunderstorm, sorry guys. The water reaches a certain point, condenses, creates an updraft, which causes more water to be sucked up, and this eventually hits the stratosphere, which we're going to talk about in a while, which is very cold. It supercools the water, and that supercooled water then begins to fall down in hailstones. Now that, not all hailstones hit the ground, because as they fall down, they can reheat up and form into liquid again. But this process going up creates an anvil at the top of your tube, and you get round circulating currents, very strong updraft, and the hailstones drop down. You can actually get hail onto the ground, and that's your thunderstorm, so supercooled water. So this updraft can actually updraft small crickets, frogs, mostly frogs, and these frogs will be sucked up into the air and coated with supercooled water, and that supercooled water will be covered again and again as it drops. As it encounters each drop, that drop will then wrap around the surface as a liquid, but then hit an impurity and turn suddenly to ice. And so when it hits the ground, you can break open a hailstone and see a frog inside. So that's something worth your while to look up on the internet, frogs inside hailstones. In general, you can pick up a hailstone and well, it's still cold. If you've got to have a cold situation, you can cut it open with a scale, a scalpel, look under with a bit of polarized light down a microscope or any sort of viewing scope, and you can see the different polarization onion skins, skins on it. And I have actually done that. I've never myself seen a frog. I've seen a tiny insect, but they're the things to see. And of course, as it's rushing down, as the hailstone's rushing down, it's causing a large charging in the clouds. And not all thunder, there are lightning from other clouds besides thunderstorms, but the lightning which tends to strike the ground comes from, in general, thunderstorms. There's lots and lots of thunder, and we now have sophisticated computers which tell us exactly where thunder strikes. And of course, if we have a fire and no thunder strikes, on the way to getting the fireys out, we also phone up the police and say, hey, this is obviously suspicious. For those things. One of the interesting things is that instability, the potential energy and instability, the moisture and the heat in the air sets up first, and then the thunderstorm comes in often the opposite direction from the direction prevailing direction of the wind as an instability shockwave. Now, I've sort of known that and seen it and had it explained to me, but I think there's some satellite images of thunderstorms happening in Florida. You see the small little puffy clouds occur in Florida, and then you see the thunderstorms sweep across. So thunderstorms can travel at a fairly fast pace due to the fact that it's not necessarily a wind weather-driven thing. It's a instability. Of course, the rain comes down. The rain coming down releases the potential energy from the ground, which powers the thunderstorm, which allows it to sort of slowly walk across hot landscapes. Before we finish here, there's an Australian documentary called Miracles of this German paraglider who, her and a Chinese person, there's an updraft alley from Sydney up to Goulburn that paragliders like flying along, and they had a series of storm cells So they like storm individual cell. That's great. They can get high altitude with their parachute. So this is a parachute. The person with a piece of silk on a I don't know. I suppose they're towed up there. Or I think they're on a hill. They jump off a hill and they can fly for basically as long as there's sunlight hours. I think I've got to think you want to fly at night. So there was a series of storm cells. Storm cells came together in a big storm cell, which sucked these two people up. The Chinese person got fried with a lightning bolt, and she went up and up and eventually began to lose consciousness as she was in the stratosphere far too high. She couldn't get down, and her chute... she got thrown out of the storm cell, and her chute was full of ice. It's not the ice which drops there, it's a liquid rain which then freezes, and her chute became unstable. It collapsed, and then she fell for a huge time, and her chute magically reopened, and she was able to fly home. I think the American crossing of the Atlantic in an aircraft, they had the aircraft not able to fly above the weather at the stage, flying through the weather. So in the olden days between the wars, mail flights, and there's a lot of flights were very dangerous, as people actually had to fly through thunderstorms as they flew through thunderstorms. It's not necessarily the lightning which got them. This person, I do remember, had ice forming on the wings. I think even today aircraft have these special heaters on their wings to de-ice their wings, and the ice forms on the wings. Simply, it's not, you know, that it's not ice particles. If you had a cube of ice and wanted to actually put it onto a wing, it would be rather difficult because it would keep on bouncing off. No, this is like Frozone. There you go, Frozone from The Incredibles is exactly like that. This is supercooled water, which is water beneath 0 degrees C, and when it gets a little tap, it hits there. So we've just covered there now the troposphere, where the weather is, and the wild child is water. The wild child is water, and water's got the property that it's lighter than air. You've got this convection happening, which thrusts up there. You have things like supercooled water, but eventually it turns to ice, turns to cloud, and so your water as an individual molecule is a radical. You know, it's, well, I mean, not a radical. It's mad. It can actually start to float up. As soon as it hits two molecules, or into a droplet, it becomes heavy. Now, it can become so light that it doesn't accelerate down really quickly. It becomes very light. But it stops going up. So the troposphere is water. Then you hit the stratosphere, and besides stratospheric clouds, which are water where it shouldn't be, but they're little ice clouds, cirrus clouds, there's no water there whatsoever. Occasionally you might have a volcano pushing things up where it's uninvited, or you may have a thunderstorm which pushes air up, and you get the anvil. The planes sort of fly around the thunderstorms, not very fun, and that's the stratosphere. Now, what's happening is, as you increase with altitude, something is robbing the heat. It's cooling down. Now, again, a lot of people will say, look, don't you know the basic facts you've learned at school? Clouds float. Okay, this is giving you the science. And things are naturally colder higher up. Now, there is a little bit of science here, and we introduce our next wild child. Two wild childs I have. One is the universe. The universe is a staggering two something or other degrees Kelvin. It's nearly absolute zero. So the sun, hot, 5,000 degrees. Off to the side of the sun, 2 degrees Kelvin. This is all in Kelvin. It's cooled. Well, it's not so much cooled, it's expanded. Similar like it's frozen. It's like your fridge or your spray can. If you expand it, it freezes. And outer space is really cold. And if you couple to outer space, you get really cold. So there's instances of Apollo 13, they began to really freeze because they required heaters all the time up there in their little spacecraft because they weren't getting enough sunlight and they were radiating out heat faster than they were absorbing. And so a lot of the solar cells in this space station are devoted to providing heating. So that's an interesting aspect. Now, if you don't believe it's cold in space, a lot of the time when meteors hit the ground, people run to it and they expect it to be glowing like it does in the movies, the E.T. movies or whatever it is, where it's all glowing, it's hot, and often you show people touching a meteorite and it's hot. Well, in fact, the majority of people who observe meteors which have just landed on the ground, obviously they can't be too big, the size of a car would cause a huge explosion. I don't know how this works. Even though it's caused a lot of damage and stuff like that, and equivalent to an explosion, the actual meteor itself is covered with frost. It's gone to an equilibrium pressure, a temperature somewhere down at liquid nitrogen temperature, and if it's big enough not to cook on the outside, it's sort of like putting a frozen turkey in the oven really quickly for Thanksgiving. So I know I'm going to turn the oven up to 600 degrees and put it in for 10 minutes. So what will happen is the turkey will look hot on the outside, but as you cut it in, it won't be thawed. So a lot of the meteors hitting ground aren't thawed. So we're still in the troposphere. The culprit here is carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide has a emission bands in the infrared, and so it gets hit by a reasonably hot molecule. It excites it. It says, thank you very much, I've got an excited emission band. And that emission band, it can emit it downwards, but it also emits it out into space. So carbon dioxide is the thing which is cooling the atmosphere. Okay, now this is a bit hard for you to accept. Carbon dioxide is the bad child because it locks in the infrared radiation closer to the ground, but above the ground it's very good at converting atmospheric temperature into radiation, and so it starts to cool things down. So what's happening is the water goes up, and as the atmosphere is cooled down by the carbon dioxide radiation, this is true, guys, clouds form, and we then hit the stratosphere, which is, say, your next level where your parents are. Nice ordered downstairs. It's fun and games. People are running up and down, yelling at things, thunderstorms, throwing things down, hail, water, rain. Now, the interesting thing is that the actual troposphere is actually relatively, if some pollution gets in it, it's been churned all the time. It's been washed through the water. Carbon dioxide has been pushed through the water, and water's running through it, so if there's a bit of acid rain in there, water's cleaning it through. So it's actually basically the good circulation lungs for us animals. It's been cleaned all the time, so keep that in mind. The stratosphere is a different thing. The stratosphere has jet streams. So an example of the early understanding of the stratosphere came from courtesy of Japan. So Japan put up some helium balloons before World War II and noticed that they went straight across to the United States. And some of the earliest understanding of the jet stream was attaching small bombs to helium balloons and dropping them on the United States. And I think that was a very heroic effect. I don't think it was helium balloons, because I don't think the Japanese would have had helium, but that's one of the stories that I wrote. These are the jet streams, and this is the smooth laminar flow, the strated flow. And this area is heated up because we are beginning to get ozone formation here. And ozone, we said before, absorbs two UV photons and produces three oxygens, which produce three ozones. So you have this ozone chain reaction. And so a lot of the sun's radiation in the UV, which is not hitting the Earth, it gets converted into this area, and so the stratosphere is a region where the temperature is increasing, with the more ozone spoiled there. Eventually the ozone runs out and the carbon dioxide takes over again, and that area where the temperature turns over again and begins to drop is called the mesosphere. I'd call basically the mesosphere and the stratosphere, but that's the mesosphere, and the temperature starts to drop down, and this time much more dramatically to minus 110 degrees. And then the carbon dioxide runs out, simply because the atmosphere is so thin, and it may be that the carbon dioxide is relatively heavy, can't go any further up. I really don't understand this. I'm sure there's some physics associated with it. This cooling effect stops, and then we have very thin atmosphere, so we've got Hubble space telescopes, sort of people doing spacewalks up at the stage, and the remaining atmosphere is out there for the hard UV solar radiation to come in and absolutely pack a huge amount of energy into it, and so it begins to heat up again. So you've got that W shape, that up in W shape, the temperature decreasing, then increasing the stratosphere, then decreasing the mesosphere, and then increasing again in the thermosphere. So I may have said exosphere. I mean thermosphere. Thermo means, you know, it's sort of a giveaway. What's the main feature of the thermosphere? Oh, the thermal profile. Then you've got the exosphere, which is really, you know, we've got to give something, give it a name. So we have all those characters coming together. And indeed, where is the ozone layer? Well, the ozone layer is the stratosphere and mesosphere. That's where it is. That's where it's doing its work. And so it's a fraction, a tiny fraction of a percent, but that fraction of gas in there is absorbing all the UV radiation. So not only the ozone layer does two things. It does the absorption of UV radiation, protecting life beneath it, but it also heats the atmosphere up. Now, this is where we have to say, because it heats it up, it stops the buoyancy effect. The buoyancy only works if the layer above it is colder. If the layer above it is hotter, it stops rising. Now, they have this in the Australian nuclear reactor at Lucas Heights. They've got, it's a water nuclear reactor, you can look into it. But to stop any radioactive material ever being circulated up, so you've got radioactive isotopes and neutrons and all things going on, and it's in the radiation water underneath the top layer, it's heated up. It's called a thermocline, and it's like a big lid. It's hotter water, it's lighter, it floats on top. And that's just held there for everyone a day at a slightly, gently increased temperature than the rest of the nuclear reactor. Now, you can do this example in the classroom. You get a test tube, fill it with water, and heat up the top end of the test tube where the water is. The water at the top will boil, yet the students will be able to hold the bottom of the test tube because it will be cold. There will be no circulation. Whereas if you hit at the bottom, that will, and you put a tiny piece of dye there, you'll see that that circulate. Alternatively, you can do the opposite type of stuff, and that's put a lot of salt in your test tube, a fair amount of salt, shake it up and down so it's just dissolved, and then carefully add in low density water on top of it. Now, what that will mean is that you've got a density gradient there. So when you heat it up, there'll be, because the water underneath is already dense and it won't, its increase due to temperature is not going to be enough for convection, that water will actually sit at the bottom of the test tube and vibrate. And so the student will have a match and hold the test tube, and they will suddenly feel this vibration. You should see the eyes light up, and that in fact is what's happening in the centre of the sun. So we've got all these features, And there are these factors of space in that you go up to the top of a mountain for a ski trip. It's cold because space is cold. It's cold because carbon dioxide is draining the heat and radiating it out to space. That's an important fact, or an interesting thing that people neglect to mention. They sort of like to teach this customary knowledge that the top mountains are cold because they're snowy. Then there's carbon dioxide, water. Water's lighter than air. And that's because the water's rising, the clouds are formed. Again, you've got the customary knowledge that clouds float. Okay, so you've got customary knowledge and the scientific knowledge. It's very difficult to get that in, to set it up as a student. You as a adult podcast listener will have a different view. And then the stratosphere and the mesosphere is the ozone layer, and that's absorbing heat. Again, that's probably a little bit hard. It's much easier to think about your destination, not your journey through the stratosphere. We've really got different layers. Again, we'll go through it again. The troposphere, the stratosphere, the mesosphere, the thermosphere, and above that, the exosphere. And we've got three gases which work together but give the atmosphere these crazy properties. We've got carbon dioxide, which traps heat but also radiates out heat. It's a major cooling mechanism of the atmosphere. We've got water, which loves to rush up, but then it runs out of steam, so to speak. It runs out of steam, turns into cloud. Then we've got ozone. Now, the thing with the stratosphere is that it's very peaceful, it's clean, not much is happening there. And if you dirty the stratosphere, you can actually put in pollution in the stratosphere, which will take an awful long time to get out. So we say that in Krakatoa, blew up in Indonesia, it blew up sufficiently to punch a lot of its pollution into the stratosphere. In the stratosphere, the pollution then went around the Earth, meaning that there were red sunsets for years. And again, when that volcanic ash went up into the stratosphere, which is, we all know, the stratosphere is there because jet airlines like to fly in it. That was a rude awakening. So the stratosphere is very... not much happening. There are powerful winds blowing in one direction forever, so it's a pretty boring to go up there. And it's very clean. There's not much water there. The water's frozen, fallen out of it. If you were to smell, it would smell a bit ozone-y. I'd say I think humans would be able to smell the amount of ozone up there. But also when it gets dirty, it stays dirty. Down in the messy, rumpus room of the world, the troposphere, there's weather going all the time, and water is running through, purging and cleaning our atmosphere. So it's acid rain. Yes, it is acid rain, but thank goodness it's actually taking that pollution out of the atmosphere. Obviously, we're running it in and killing our plants and killing the fish, but at least it's churning through. It's sort of like it's steam cleaning. It's almost like a dishwasher. Well, we know you leave something out, things rain washes things clean. It's a very interesting thing. Of course, the rain and the weather causes erosion, causes a whole heap of things. A powerful force for erosion is the chemicals and the washed in the water in the stratosphere, and the water running and abrading things creates a lot of the atmosphere for it. So that's a podcast which has hopefully introduced you to the atmosphere, but seeing more from the field of looking at the actual physics of what's going on. And the previous podcast, I introduced you to ozone and water and resisted the temptation of when someone said, look, the ozone layer is only 3 millimetres thick, resist the temptation initially to launch into a detailed explanation of exactly where the ozone layer is. I've sort of waited and built up a collective understanding of 3 different molecules, 3 different properties, and how those properties link. The ozone is linked to the sun, carbon dioxide is linked to the surface of the earth, but also to space. And water is an amazing child who gets power to do things and then loses it in a beautiful cycle. That's my atmosphere, and thank you for coming aboard this flight of scientific understanding. Thanks for listening, and in the meantime, keep on doing science.